Welcome to the Feminine Podcast, the official podcast of Feminine, talking about a little bit of femme, a little bit of VM, and everything in between. Yes, audience, it's Risa E. Lewis, host for the Feminine Podcast. Today, I'm sitting with a guest. Her name is Dr. Christine Lane. Christine, please say hello to the audience.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
So maybe you don't recognize this woman's name. However, you should, and I think by the end of our program today, you're going to definitely know who she is. Christine, I could go on and on about you, but first, why don't you share what you'd like the audience to know about yourself?
So I'm Christine Lane. I'm a general internal medicine physician, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Annals of Internal Medicine.
Wait. Did you say, can you repeat that piece?
I think I said, Dr. Christine Lane, I'm a general internist and the editor-in-chief of Annals of Internal Medicine.
So, audience, you can understand how excited I am to be sitting with Dr. Christine Lane. She is the editor-in-chief of the Annals of Internal Medicine. Christine, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it's very exciting for me. It's very exciting for the audience. Please tell us more, whatever you'd like to share.
I'm also a senior vice president at the American College of Physicians, and I'm very proud to be on the faculty of Jefferson Medical College, actually, I think more appropriately now known as the Sidney Kimmel College of Medicine.
And tell us a little bit about where you've come from. Have you essentially been in the Northeast, or have you been all over the country?
I've been mostly, I'm a Northeast girl. I grew up in New York. I went to college in upstate New York at Hamilton College. I went to medical school at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island. I did my internal medicine training at New York Hospital Cornell in Manhattan, and then a fellowship in general medicine and clinical epidemiology at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston.
How does one become an editor-in-chief? And Christine and I have chatted a little bit beforehand. We talked about how to share with you how you can potentially become part of the medical journal world. So, Christine, before you went to med school, I understand that writing was a part of your growing up.
It was. In fact, I was a writing major in college before I decided to go to medical school. When I made the decision to go to medical school, I added a biology major because I didn't think I was going to get into medical school as a writing major. As it turns out, I think I probably got medical school interviews because people were curious about why a writing major was applying to medical school.
Right. And of course, we know now that actually helps to get you into med school. But at the time, you were concerned that it might hurt you?
That's right.
Okay, and so then take us further along. So you did writing in college, you went to med school, you became a physician. You know, have you always, have you continued the writing, and how did you thread writing through your career to get to this position you're in now?
I actually did not do much writing after college. I went, did my residency, as I said, and then I did a fellowship, a research fellowship, and that's where I gained some skills in clinical epidemiology and research methods and critical appraisal. So I sort of left writing for a while. The other thing that I always, people are pretty surprised to find out, is as an editor, you don't do that much writing. You do a lot of rewriting and a lot of reading, but not that much writing.
One thing I found, I would say, regarding writing is the more you write, the more accustomed you get to writing. The more you read, the better you are as a writer, or the more you are able to critically assess writing. So they all sort of feed into each other.
That's certainly correct.
Yeah. So I want us to focus on journal, medical journals, and leadership positions in journals. But first, describe for the audience your current clinical practice.
So I'm on the faculty at Jefferson Medical College. I see patients once a week with the internal medicine house staff in a primary care practice there.
So it's been important for you to maintain that patient experience and working with trainees.
It is. I think, you know, in theory, I go over to the internal medicine residency practice to teach. I think I learn more than I teach.
Yeah, it's pretty humbling how things change and practice changes. However, you're probably keeping track of what's coming out in terms of the journal, in terms of the cutting edge research, and also practice changes.
That's true. I can hope I can share some of that with the residents and some of just the practical knowledge of practicing medicine for decades.
Yeah. So one of the things I try to focus on with the audience and colleagues and friends and mentees and sponsorees and fill in the iteration of person with whom I'm involved and with whom I interact is how to access. And I'll just say, so I actually grew up thinking I didn't know how to write and I wasn't a writer. And then at some point, I realized that actually some of the people that were really establishing themselves in academic medicine wrote. And that's when I just started writing and realizing the more you do it, the easier it gets and the more confidence you build. And then I was giving a lecture and I was talking about ultrasound, which is my niche within emergency medicine, and it was back at one of my home institutions, and one of my mentors was reading my CV and giving me feedback in terms of career goals and next steps, and he said, Risa, I noticed that you write, and you've written, and you're published, but you don't review for any journals, and he said, why is that? And I thought, well, I thought I had to get asked. And he's like, no, you just ask. And this story has been heard by some of my listeners. I've given it in some of my talks about this concept of just asking. So I would love to ask you your opinion about people that are looking to become reviewers. Let's start at the level of a reviewer for a medical journal. How does one become a reviewer?
I think you're absolutely correct. You could just ask. I think that different journals have different procedures. Some actually require to get CVs from their potential peer reviewers. I can tell you what we do at Annals of Internal Medicine, because when you've seen one medical journal and how they do it, you've seen one medical journal and how they do it. We actually have a database of about 20,000 individuals who have agreed to review for the journal. We, when people enter the database, they have to provide us information, including their contact information and their self-defined areas of interest. We don't get, their CVs or look at their publications or anything like that. And then everybody has at least one chance to review if we get an article in their field. Our associate editors and deputy editors rate the quality of the reviews. We also keep data on whether people provided the review, whether they provided it on time, and the quality of the review. And people who are good reviewers get rewarded with the opportunity to do it again and again. Most medical journals, even one like Annals that has a database of 20,000 reviewers, are happy to get more individuals who are interested in doing the really important work of being a volunteer peer reviewer. So I think that Risa is absolutely correct. Just ask. The worst that could happen is somebody could say, we don't need you right now.
Right. And this was based on advice given to me. And I've spoken previously in programs about this concept of a personal board of directors. And you can have the people that you contact personally, and then there's the people that you contact professionally. And so that was advice given to me. So I started asking, and listeners, I merely just started writing emails, dear editor blank journal, I'm interested in being a peer reviewer. And you get some responses, you get some positive responses, you get some negative responses, but I started becoming a reviewer just by sending those emails. Now, those of you that are already peer reviewers know that if you are just too busy or you're not in the mood to peer review, then you can turn down the request to review, and often you have the opportunity to put forward someone's name and their email address. So for those of you on the lookout to be a coach, to be a mentor, to be a sponsor, please think of people that you would like to help amplify and help move along and help provide these opportunities. So Christine, this is your world and this is your sort of verbiage. Walk us through sort of the different levels of reviewer and then editor. How do you go from being a writer to then being a peer reviewer to then being, you mentioned the word deputy, and then ultimately say someone says, you know what, I want to be an editor-in-chief. There's no linear path, I realize, and it can be different, and a lot of times it's who you know and it's timing in life, but if you could map out someone that really is interested and has this on their radar, what would you advise?
I think that you first have to have an idea of the type of journal that you would like to be affiliated with. I think that reviewing and writing are sort of opposite ends of the same activity. And if you're an active researcher and you're relying on your colleagues to peer review your work, you really owe it to your colleagues to also be a peer reviewer. So it is hard work. It's a volunteer activity. But if you are involved in the process of scholarly writing and getting your research published, you really owe it to your colleagues to also be a peer reviewer. And I think you can learn a lot in that process. I think I always say that if when I was growing up, I said I want to be the editor of a medical journal, I would have been pretty disappointed because it's not really a linear path. As you said, Risa, partly because even though there are lots and lots of medical journals, there are many more people who might want to be editors than there are journals. And, so I think that most of the people I know who have ended up as medical journal editors, there's been a large dose of serendipity in the process, and that's certainly true with me. But I think what is really important, particularly if you're going to be the editor of a clinical research journal, even more than the writing experience, I think, is the expertise in clinical medicine and the expertise in study design and analytic methods and really research methodology. I think those are, critically important to a high-quality journal.
Okay, Christine, I want to take a segue for a second for people that are wondering how to get published, because this is probably the step before peer review and sort of moving up to other leadership positions within medical journals. If someone has an idea and they want to pitch that idea, response I've received is mixed about whether you should or could directly email a journal and a journal editor and pitch the idea. So for example, dear Dr. Lane, I'm interested in writing a piece on left-handed physicians and whether or not they end up becoming full professors of internal medicine. Do you welcome those type of queries?
We welcome all types of queries. I think the worst thing that could happen if you propose a potential article to a journal is either you get no response or you get a no thank you response. I don't think you're going to do any damage to yourself by asking the question. And when people have good ideas, we encourage them to submit. At Annals, we always warn them that we can't assure you of a favorable editorial decision until we've completed our peer review process. But if somebody did propose to write an article on left-handed physicians and their professional success, we probably would say that that was a low priority question for our readers.
Okay, I mean, that was purely theoretical readers, of course. So I think there's a theme from prior programs, but also with this program of just ask. Audience, just ask. And I emphasize this because women, we often don't ask and don't know to ask in the same way that perhaps some of our male counterparts do. So, pivoting back to the concept of women, Christine and I talked a little bit about what's out there in terms of editorial boards and editors-in-chief. And don't worry, in the show notes, I will have a list of publications that talk about editorial boards over time and sort of the percentage of those boards, the makeup of women versus men, and how many editors-in-chief there are that are women. And this is one of the exciting pieces about having Christine on the program today. There aren't many women editors-in-chief. If you look at journals, some of the high-impact journals, the percentages I've seen have varied, but let's just settle that it's somewhere between 15 and 20%. It's not high. There aren't very many. That being said, if we spin this positively, it's gotten better, okay? There are more women on editorial boards. There are more women editors-in-chief, but we're certainly not where we'd like to be. And I would argue, based on some of the articles that we reviewed before the program, it actually hasn't increased that much over the last 1 to 2 decades. Discuss.
So I actually don't love the literature on this particular topic. I think that it suffers from a couple of problems. One of them is that they identify the sex of the reviewers, the authors, the editors, by their first name, which particularly if you get out of English language speaking countries, is not the best method. The other thing is they suffer from a problem if you just have no idea what the denominator is. And the denominator is not necessarily the number of women in that particular field. It's the number of women who are interested in being an author, a reviewer, or an editor-in-chief in that particular field. And none of this work can really get at the issue of whether the lower than the apparently lower proportion of women in some of these roles is because of discrimination or because women are interested in other things, or if it's just sort of a pipeline issue, and as time goes on and there are more people, more women who sort of mature through the profession in a particular field, that there will just be more women in these different activities. So, I mean, there are a lot of bean counting exercises that I don't think, that make a lot of assumptions about the reasons for the lower representation of women, but don't really provide a lot of hard evidence about what the real source is. You know, I think that it, part of it is a pipeline issue, and if you look at the proportion of women editors, it's highest in internal medicine, obstetrics, gynecology, and pediatrics, and we know that those are the specialty fields that have the largest proportion of women and have for the longest period of time. It's much lower in fields like urology or orthopedic surgery, where the proportion of women are lower. So, you know, I think to be a researcher or, you know, an author and editor of a medical journal, it's really your professional expertise that should be the defining factor, not your gender or your color of your skin or, you know, the institution that you work with. So I think that some of these bean counting exercises are not really getting us very far into understanding the reasons why and how to combat it. I think some of the issues that Risa has touched on about mentorship are really important. And I think ultimately that's really the critical factor, are women being mentored in a way that's going to allow them to achieve professional success, however they personally define professional success.
So I really welcome and love that critical response to some of these articles. And, you know, that rather than just, you know, calling the red flags up, you know, let's look really at what was studied and is it really saying what we think it's saying. That being said, you know, this sort of talk about the pipeline and women in medicine, we do know that greater than 50% of students in med school are women, and we're doing pretty well at the early career. And you and I have talked a bit about, well, something happens, or we think something happens mid-career and certainly late career. And there's a concept that I've been interested in and have discussed with many women friends, women colleagues, of invisibility and mid-career invisibility, and whether or not women are made invisible, or maybe women make themselves invisible, but there are a lot of factors at play. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, as you were moving from being a trainee to early career to mid-career, and sort of some of the potential times where you could have been made invisible or become invisible, but actually you didn't, because you're now exquisitely visible as this editor-in-chief?
Yeah, I think that I've been pretty fortunate, and I can't say that I've suffered a lot of gender discrimination in my professional life. And I really think that, you know, as I said, mentorship is important, and I really think that there are two, that I've been lucky to have many, many great mentors, but there are two instances I think that are very telling and also provide some examples of how individuals who are mentoring others can think about when they're mentoring young women or young men. And one was a mentor during my fellowship who I'm pretty shy by, you know, I have a pretty shy personality, and I was going to some research meetings with this mentor. And he told me that if I didn't speak up at least three times during each day of the meeting, he wasn't ever going to let me come to another research meeting. He wasn't going to pay for me to attend another research meeting.
That's fantastic. He was sort of trying to, was he trying to boost your voice, boost your confidence, boost?
I think that there may be some people who would have been insulted by that. I think that was tremendously empowering for me. And to this day, when I'm in a setting and I'm thinking of saying something and I'm reticent to do it, I have him sitting on my shoulder saying, just say something three times and I'll provide you funding to go to the next meeting.
Fantastic.
So that was related to sort of just, you know, boosting confidence and giving me permission to use my voice, or the confidence to use my voice. The other one, we know that, you know, there are differences in the proportion of time that men and women spend on taking care of children and those sorts of activities. And a lot of that is by choice. And I think that if women choose to go into areas of medicine or that are where they're not writing a lot of research grants because they'd rather take time, spending time with their family. That's great. Everybody needs to find their own way. But for me, I almost fell out of the academic pipeline. It was very early in my work at the medical journal. I was an associate editor. It's a very part-time position. And at that point, my son, who was 5 years old at the time, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And at that point, I was working half at the medical school and half at the journal. And I went into the then editor of the medical journal, a man named Frank Davidoff, and I told him that I was going to stop working at the journal because I really needed to focus on taking care of my son. And it just made sense between my job and my husband's job. I had a little bit more flexibility, and I was going to do that. And he shut the door of the office and said, sit down. And he said, I'm not going to let you stop. He said, we'll figure out how to do this. He's like, your son's going to have to go to school, and you're not going to be able to go with him, so let's figure out how to do this. And so we arranged a way where I could, until the teachers at the school were comfortable, giving my son his, checking his sugar and giving him his insulin injections, Frank let me leave in the middle of the day, drive to the school, educate the teachers, and, after about 6 weeks, everything was good. I was still working at the journal, and it's probably also better for my son in the long run. So I think, recognizing these points where people really may just kind of fall out of the academic pipeline and figuring out ways to make the work environment such that you can accommodate some of these things.
I think also that story illustrates that often we think we have no options, but actually we do have options sometimes that we just don't even know about. And that's a very inspiring sort of story. And that sort of that was around the time that maybe you would have stepped away, become professionally invisible, so to speak.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay. So you brought up some of this literature that we've reviewed, and we're going to look at it critically. One thing that I thought was interesting that talked about the fact that the numbers speak. There are fewer women editors-in-chief. And one of the reasons cited is there are no term limits. Can you discuss, and I'm not expecting you to know the term limits of every single journal, but that concept of term limits. And at some point, there should be movement. There should be a rotation.
I think that, I myself worry. I've been the editor of Annals for 10 years, and sometimes I think maybe is that, long enough, and should I move on to other things? Not for my own good, but maybe for the success of the journal. And I think there is a huge amount of variability. Some journals that have part-time editors who are doing this in concert with, a full academic workload do have term limits, and the editorial office of the journal will rotate every 3 years or every 5 years. And then there are other journals like Annals and the New England Journal and JAMA, Lancet, British Medical Journal that have, paid full-time editorial staff, and those journals tend not to have term limits that are written down in stone. I think the longest editorial term at Annals was approaching, there was a person who was editor for almost 40 years. That seems long to me, and that was many decades ago. But we don't have term limits, but I think the thing that term limits do that's good, whether you're talking about gender equity or any other issue, is that they do breathe new life into the journal. So I think they probably, turnover is probably a good thing.
That is a perfect setup to talk about breathing fresh air. So I'm a big fan of visual abstracts, and I think they're a great way to demonstrate data, to demonstrate a message, to demonstrate research. Now, it's got to be done responsibly. It's got to be done well. And I've seen little sprinkles of this in emergency medicine at conferences, and some of the journals have been introducing this concept. Can you share Annals of Internal Medicine, how they're approaching visual abstracts and whether there's a plan to integrate them?
Yeah, so interestingly, it's a very timely question because starting on July 2nd of this year, we started developing visual abstracts to accompany all of our original research articles. We've experimented with it a little bit in the past, but not in a, it hasn't been a routine feature of the journal. So now if you go to Annals, or you might see it on social media, there's a one-panel visual abstract that accompanies all original research articles. I think that their, you know, their purpose is not to convey all the caveats in every finding from a particular study, but I think they are very good at giving one bottom line from the study and hopefully engaging people to take a closer look at the full article. They are really hard to develop well, really, really hard. I think that we didn't think they were going to be easy, but now doing this for the last couple of months, there's a lot of iteration between me, the graphic designer, then it goes to the editor who handled the paper, and it goes to the author. And we have to, particularly at a journal like Annals that is very into methods and very into stating all the limitations that go with an article, to get away from that. And this is just one sort of soundbite from the article.
Listeners, if you're not familiar with visual abstracts, I'll put a link in the show notes about how to read more and how to develop your own. Christine, I realize you have a very packed schedule, and you have no idea how appreciative I am that you took time to speak with me and speak with the audience today. I'm going to dovetail off this, like, say three things. And for those of our listeners that are wondering how to jumpstart, how to jump in, and how to sort of release their imposter syndrome regarding writing and becoming a peer reviewer, could you offer three thoughts of something that they can just do right now today?
I think one thing they can do is, if they have any interest in reviewing for an internal medicine journal, they should find my email. It's really easy to find on annals.org, and send an email to me or our managing editor saying that you'd like to review, and we'll add you to that big database. The other thing is, you have to be an active reader. So I think pick a couple of journals in your field, read them, approach the editors to see if you could be a peer reviewer. And if you have an idea about something to write, as Risa mentioned, contact the editor and see if he or she is interested in that. And then the other thing, I think, is just to be conscious of your colleagues, and particularly colleagues that are junior to you, and thinking about ways to encourage and support them to get involved in some of these activities as well.
Very inspiring. Amazing. Thank you, Christine. Thank you, audience. Until we speak again.